Exodus chapter 20, beginning at verse 1. And God spoke all these words. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sins of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, nor your son or daughter, nor your manservant or maidservant, nor your animals, nor the alien within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, but he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Honor your father and your mother, so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his manservant or maidservant, his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. When the people saw the thunder and lightning, and heard the trumpet, and saw the mountain in smoke, they trembled with fear. They stayed at a distance, and said to Moses, "Speak to us yourself, and we will listen, but do not have God speak to us, or we will die." Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid. God has come to test you, so that the fear of God will be with you to keep you from sinning." The people remained at a distance while Moses approached the thick darkness where God was.
Well, now we've seen over the last 8 weeks that the book of Exodus, like the whole Bible, is first and foremost a book about God. And so the main point of this series is for us to see what it means for God to be God as we study the book of Exodus. Last week we saw that God being God means that he is not only a God who rescues, but he also has a purpose and a program for the people who he's rescued. As a result of God being their God, the Israelites have become a people with a unique past. They'd been rescued, a unique privilege. They belonged to God as his treasured possession, and a unique purpose. They were to be a blessing to all nations as they demonstrated to the world what it meant to be God's people living under his direct rule. But the striking thing about this encounter with God at Mount Sinai is that it occupies so much of the thought of the Bible. Having brought the Israelites out of the land of slavery in Egypt, you know, you and I might expect God to kind of whisk them straight into the promised land that he prepared for them. But he doesn't. Instead, they spend over 11 months camped at the foot of this mountain in the Sinai desert, and whereas you or I, if we were writing the story from a human perspective, might easily have skimmed over this static period and raced on to a slightly more sort of exciting and interesting narrative journey through the desert, well, Moses doesn't. He gives only a handful of chapters to the journey with all the excitement of the battles and all the rest of it, and over 56 chapters to this static period of 11 months. The Israelites don't actually move on from this mountainous encounter until Numbers chapter 10. All the rest of Exodus, all of Leviticus, much of Numbers, most of Deuteronomy, following Numbers, are given over to description and commentary on this period of history. And then as we read through the rest of the Bible, we find that over and over again it's referred to. So obviously what goes on here at the foot of this mountain is these Israelite nomads, these refugees, pitch their tents and wait and meet with God is vitally important to God's people and to our understanding of what it means for God to be God. It's all very well knowing that we belong to him as his treasured possession. It's all very well knowing that we've got this wonderful purpose, this worldwide purpose. But this mountainous encounter is obviously vital to us if we're going to know who it is that's living amongst us and what it is that he desires of his people. And so this week we're going to learn two key lessons about God's character. And next week, as we stay at the foot of the mountain, we're going to learn a key lesson about ourselves and how God's people can survive with God living amongst them. So this week, two vital lessons. First, God is holy. Secondly, God is gracious. Very simple. And those are two lessons which I hope we'll be able to go home and ponder on and think about through the week. God is holy. God is gracious. And so the aim of this evening is for us to see that the God who we serve is both holy and that he's gracious towards his people. First then, the holy God. The word, the noun holy, the adjective holiness, comes up over and again in the Bible. It means literally set apart. And the root of its word has its origins in cutting. And with so many budding surgeons in a congregation like this, there's no need to dwell on the matter. When you cut something and sever it from something else, it becomes separate and apart. So the language of holiness refers to the distinctiveness, the otherness, the separateness of God's character. Listen to the systematic theologian David Wells. The fact that God is holy means that there is an otherness to him. And in our passage today, his holiness is emphasized in two ways. First, visually, and secondly, verbally. So, if you're taking notes, 1a. God's visual revelation shows him to be holy. Now, we didn't have time to read the bulk of chapter 19, but if we had, we'd have seen that either side of God's verbal revelation of himself in chapter 20 with the Ten Commandments is this visual revelation of himself. And the visual revelation serves to emphasize and underline the points being made by the spoken word. And in that respect, the signs and wonders that happen at this mountain are like all the other signs and wonders in the book of Exodus and all the other signs and wonders in the whole of the Bible. They're unique, one-off, historical events whose purpose is to underline and confirm the verbal message they accompany. So as God descends to speak with his people, they learn this visually. He is the God of absolute divine authority. He is the God of absolute moral purity. Let's just read what we didn't have time to read earlier, Exodus 19, verses 10 to 17. We're on page 77. The Lord said to Moses, "Go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow. Make them wash their clothes and be ready by the third day, because on that day the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. Put limits for the people around the mountain and tell them, 'Be careful that you don't go up the mountain or touch the foot of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall be put to death. He shall surely be stoned or shot with arrows. Not a hand is to be laid on him. Whether man or animal, he shall not be permitted to live. Only when the ram's horn sounds a long blast may they go up the mountain.' After Moses had gone down to the mountain to the people, he consecrated them and they washed their clothes. Then he said to the people, 'Prepare yourselves for the third day. Abstain from sexual relations.' On the morning of the third day, there was thunder and lightning with a thick cloud over the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast. Everyone in the camp trembled. And then Moses led the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. And Mount Sinai was covered with smoke because the Lord descended on it in fire. The smoke billowed up from it like smoke from a furnace. The whole mountain trembled violently, and the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder. Then Moses spoke, and the voice of God answered him. Now just turn the page to chapter 20, verse 18. When the people saw the thunder and lightning and heard the trumpet and saw the mountain in smoke, they trembled with fear. They stayed at a distance and said to Moses, "Speak to us yourself and we will listen, but do not have God speak to us or we will die." So visually, these two points are being made, and we can see the points being made by the commands for the Israelites to prepare and consecrate themselves. God is altogether morally pure and other and distinct. The point is being made by the commands for Moses to put limits around the mountain. God is altogether absolutely divine in his authority and moral purity. The point is made by the appearance of the Lord in thunder and lightning and thick cloud and trumpet blast. God is absolute in his divine authority. And if you've ever been in an earthquake, I'm told that it's one of the most terrifying experiences available on this earth. Everything we consider to be secure and stable begins to turn to jelly underneath us, and houses crumble, streets crack, buildings are torn in two. You may have seen in the Times on Monday that the Reverend Alex Davy, defending champion of the Clergy Golfing Society, was struck twice by lightning this time last week. I have to say he seemed totally unmoved by it, which probably tells us more about Alex Davy than it does about anything else. But if you've ever been in one of those thunderstorms that comes right overhead and crashes above you, well, you'll know how terrifying it can be. Then there's the smoke billowing up, the trumpets sounding louder and louder. It's no wonder then, is it, that the people react in fear and trembling. Look at chapter 19, verse 9. The Lord said to Moses, "I'm going to come to you in a dense cloud so that the people will hear me speaking with you and will always put your trust." I've got the wrong verse there. Where do they react in trembling and fear? They do. I've lost it. Doesn't matter, but we see them react in trembling and fear. Everyone in the camp trembles. They tremble with fear, they stay at a distance, they say to Moses, "Speak to us yourself and we will listen, but don't have God speak to us or die, or we will die." So do you see God's holiness, his absolute divine authority, his absolute moral purity is being emphasized and underlined by this visual revelation of himself. Here is a meeting with somebody who's altogether separate and other. He's come from outside. He is supremely greater than his people. His mere visual appearance instills awe and trembling and fear. But it's important that we realize that in spite of the fear, the purpose of his appearance is not to petrify us. The point, rather, is to reinforce the verbal message. Just have a look at chapter 19, verse 9. This is where we come back to verse 9. Here we see on either side of the verbal appearance, in this visual revelation, God shows us the reason for the visual revelation of himself. "I'm going to come to you in a dense cloud so that people will hear me speaking with you and will always put their trust in you." And then on the other side of the Ten Commandments, chapter 20 and verse 20, Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid. God has come to test you so that the fear of God will be with you to keep you from sinning." Listen to John Calvin on these verses. "They were terrified then, not that they might be stupefied with astonishment, but only that they might be humbled and submit themselves to God." That's certainly the way the writer of the Hebrews takes it in Hebrews 12. "See to it," he says, "that you do not refuse him who speaks. If they did not escape when they refused him who warned them on earth, how much less will we if we turn away from him who warns us from heaven? Let us worship God acceptably with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire." So here is a unique, a one-off, visual demonstration of the holiness of God. He is awesome in his absolute divine authority. He is awesome in his absolute moral purity. I wonder how often we in our generation stop to ponder and to think of God like this. I wonder when the last time was that any of us paused to contemplate the majestic otherness of God. As we do, we'll find that it causes us to take his word more seriously. Listen to David Wells again. God's sharp edges have all been ground down to make him less threatening, more comfortable, more tame. He is rarely today perceived as the God of the outside, who in his awesome greatness summons his people to worship, to hear that word of truth that they cannot find within themselves or their world, to become agents of righteousness in a world that scorns this righteousness. Robbed of such a God, worship loses its awe, the truth of his word loses its ability to compel, obedience loses its virtue, and the church loses its moral authority. Now, please don't get me wrong. We in our generation have a huge privilege. If we belong to Jesus Christ, we have been made holy by him. We have the immense privilege of being able to draw near to him, to call him our Father. We have access to God. We have an intimate family relationship with him. We're his treasured possession. But let's beware of losing this right sense of awe and this right reverence, this right fear that comes from knowing who he is. Without it, well, we won't listen to him when he speaks. We won't stick to his word. We won't take his word seriously. We won't worship him with reverence and awe. So God is holy. His visual revelation shows him to be holy. He reveals himself in his absolute divine authority and his absolute moral purity as he gathers his people to listen to his word. But part two of this first point about the holiness of God then flows on from that. God is holy. His visual revelation of himself shows that. God is holy. His verbal revelation of himself demonstrates that to be the case. The Ten Commandments in Exodus 20 demonstrate verbally and emphasize verbally what has already been shown visually. And all ten of those Ten Commandments flow out of the truths that God has already shown the Israelites as he's revealed himself to them in the rest of Exodus. That's the point of verse 1. In Exodus 20, God spoke all these words. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. So it's important we realize that God has already acted in history to call together this people, a people with a unique past, a unique privilege, and a unique purpose. He's already defined himself and shown him through the first 18, 19 chapters of Exodus to be a God who has a purpose for his special people, a God who stands apart from all other gods, a God who rescues. And so comes the first command in verse 2, which flows out of all that we've already learned about God in Exodus 1 to 18 and 1 to 19. Because of who he is, because of what he's done for his people, so says God, there is to be no rival attraction. Let's have a look at verse 3. You shall have no other gods before me. That word before me is literally before my face. And it's used in the rest of the Bible to describe adultery. When a person takes another wife, while his first wife is still alive, you'd say, he'd taken a wife before my face. So do you see what God is saying? He's saying, I've rescued you. I'm coming to live amongst you. There's to be no rival attraction. I am holy and different to all other gods. I have absolute divine authority. There's no place for adultery in this relationship. There's to be no mixed portfolio, no other person in the marriage, if you like. Unlike all the other religions of their day, the Israelites are to put all their eggs in one basket. and to have undivided devotion to the one God who has rescued them. No rival attraction. Then verse 3, no idle speculation. And again, this verse flows out of the first verse. God has already revealed himself. I am the Lord, Yahweh, the God who rescues, the Creator God of Genesis 1, the God, the Father of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. I am the Lord your God. So there's to be no idle speculation, because I've already shown myself to be the God I am. He's already defined himself. He's told his people what he's like. He's shown himself to be God, the faithful God of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. And we could go all the way back to the beginning of the Genesis account to see what he's shown the Israelites already about what he's like. And so now that he's defined himself through his revelation, well, he says there's to be no idle speculation. You're not to make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in the heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shan't bow down to them or worship them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sins of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. So do you see the point here? Now that he has defined himself and shown what he's like, so his people are not to kind of carve their own images of him, make up their own ideas of what he's like and bow down to worship them. Just a couple of months ago, Julian took a skiing party. It sounded like a thoroughly good idea, away to France or Italy or somewhere. And as he taught the book of Romans, which was his reason for going to this, to this group of people, a number of folk on the ski party, Christian people, took exception to what was written there. And Julian tells us that again and again, he took them back to the verses that were written down in Paul's letter in Romans. And people saw what was written. They realized what was written. They understood it. And their reply again and again was, oh, I don't like to think of God like that. Maybe that's what Paul says, but you know, no, my God's just slightly different to that. The second command said, there is only one God. He's revealed himself. He's shown us what he's like. There's to be no idle speculation about him. And then the third commandment in verse 7. No self-promotion. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God. For the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. God alone is God. His people aren't to use his name in order to gain personal benefit for themselves. See, misusing the name of the Lord is far more than just using his word as a swear word, bad as that may be. It has to do with using God's name for one's own personal gain. So God's people aren't to pretend to be serving him as they enter the land, whilst really looking to advance their own reputation. And once again, that springs out of God's action and God's revelation of himself so far in chapters 1 through 19. He's the one who's rescued them. He's the one who created them. They belong to him and him alone. He is the true creator God, the God of Genesis 1, the God of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. So they are to seek his glory and his honor and not their own. And then verse 9, 8 and 9, through to verse 11, keeping the Sabbath day holy. I take it is that there is to be no confusion of identity. They're to keep remembering where they've come from, the Creator God. And in Deuteronomy, where we have this repeated, where they're going, the Redeemer God, who has a place ready and prepared for them in heaven. So the Ten Commandments, this verbal revelation of himself, show God's absolute divine authority. There is only one God. He is the God of Genesis 1, the creator of all things. He's the God of Abraham, of Isaac, of Jacob. He is the covenant rescuing God. And then verses 12 through 17 show us that he is the God of absolute moral purity. Honor your father and mother so that you may live long in the land. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not give false testimony. You shall not covet. We'll come back to them in just a moment. I wonder if you remember those days in your teens when the whole school would be swept from one craze to another. One week it was Liam Gallagher. The next it was Ginger Spice. The week after it was the Ninja Warriors or the Nintendo Turtles or whichever way around it is. In my day I think it was yo-yos and punk rock. Something about children, isn't there, and their lack of roots and insecurity that enables them to be just swept back and forth and blown by every wind of fashion. They don't quite yet know who they are and what they stand for. See, here are God's people being given an exposition of the character of God who is going to come and dwell amongst them. Here is the God whose treasured possession they are. Here is God for whose purpose they're to go into the land and demonstrate to the people what kind of God it is that they're serving. And God's plan for his people is that they are altogether more mature than the infantile child. He's rescued them. They have a unique past, a unique privilege, a unique purpose. They've been chosen by him. He dwells amongst them. And here at the mountain, he shows them what it is to have the God of heaven and earth come to dwell amongst them. They are to be different, to be holy, to be other. They're to stand anchored, secure, rock solid. As they enter the land, there'll be any number of alternatives available. And of course, the danger would be that they'll be blown here and there to compromise, to give a little, to begin to worship at alternative shrines. But God says to them, no, there's to be no rival attraction. However demanding the boss, or attractive the career, however pleasurable the hobby, or alluring the plaything, however appealing the relationship, or compelling the claim, now there's to be no rival attraction to the absolute divine authority. Only one God. No other God before his face. All eggs in one basket. Undivided devotion. There's to be no idle speculation. However much their neighbors and friends might urge them to give a little, not to be so rigid or narrow, to at least admit that there might be many routes to God, or maybe to concede that God's revealed will on sex outside marriage and adultery is perhaps out of date or culturally specific. No, there's to be no idle speculation amongst God's people as they stand secure and solid. There's to be no self-promotion. Now, the temptation to them as they head into the land surely will be to conduct their service with their eyes on themselves, with mixed motives. Looking to draw attention to themselves, to serve God and his people, wanting really to gain benefit for me. No self-promotion, no confused identity. They're to take time out regularly to remember where they are from and where they're going. First then, God is holy. He shows himself to be holy in his visual revelation of himself, emphasizing his absolute divine authority. He shows himself to be holy in his verbal revelation, emphasizing his absolute divine authority and moral purity. But secondly, at the mountain, they learn this other truth about their God. God is gracious. And God again shows himself to be gracious in two ways in this episode at the foot of the mountain. Both in his divine rule of his people and in his offer of a divine relationship with his people. Now we're going to look at the second six commands because we didn't look at them at length in the first section to show God's goodness in the divine rule that he provides for his people. And as we come to live in an increasingly post-Christian era in our society, it's becoming more and more abundantly obvious to anybody who looks how gracious and how good this divine rule for God's people is. Verse 12. honour your father and mother. Well, it's obvious, isn't it, when we look around, that there are no winners when a daughter or a son is turned against their mother or father. Dysfunctional family life is unattractive. Some of us who've experienced it will know how horrible it is. God in His grace wants His people to experience the goodness and the graciousness of His divine rule. Verse 13, you shall not murder. Well, it's obvious, isn't it? Now, as uncontrolled hatred and abuse increases in our society, there are no winners. Just take road rage, for an example. I expect many of us have suffered from it. No winners when a casual disagreement over whose right of way it is turns into a punch-up or even, in some cases, a murder. Verse 14, you shall not commit adultery. Well, it's obvious to us now, isn't it, that as family life starts to disintegrate, as sexual promiscuity becomes the norm, there are no winners when a whole society overturns God's revealed plan for His people. No winners when a child doesn't have the benefit of a stable, monogamous, parental relationship. Now, the political and sociological commentators may speak in hushed whispers about the benefits of new definitions of family or redefined sexual ethics in the post-Christian society, but when we actually come face to face with it, it's quite obvious to anybody who has to pick up the pieces that there are no winners in a society where adultery is the norm. One of our friends admitted to us just the other day, these are her words almost verbatim, you Christians are so lucky. You have no idea what sexual hang-ups our marriage has as a result of us both sleeping around so much before we were married. No winners in an adulterous society. God's divine rule for His people is gracious and good. And we could go on. Verse 15, you shall not steal. Verse 16, you shall not give false testimony. Verse 17, you shall not covet your neighbor's house. He wants us to be free from the emotional, physical, personal damage of break-ins, theft, lies in the law courts, jealousy, keeping up with the Joneses. There are no winners in a society like that. God is good. And these commands show us, as He declares His character to us, that He is gracious and good. So now let's draw some of the threads together. This mountainous encounter is one of the major events which dominates the Bible story. God is revealing His character. First, He shows Himself to be holy. Both His visual and His verbal revelation of Himself show us that He is absolute in divine authority and absolute in moral purity. Secondly, He shows Himself to be gracious to His people. He is gracious in His provision of divine rule. Finally, He is gracious in His provision of a divine relationship. And this point is made most clearly in chapter 24, which is the concluding verses to this opening section of the second half of the book of Exodus. So just flick over to Exodus 24, which is really the end point of this opening section of the second half of Exodus. Now, verse 3 and 7 are not that surprising to us, given what we've just learned. When Moses went out and told the people all the Lord's words and laws, they responded with one voice, "Everything the Lord has said, we will do." Verse 7. Then Moses took the book of the covenant and read it to the people. They responded, "We will do everything the Lord has said. We will obey." Well, now, wouldn't you have said that? Here they are being offered a relationship with the holy, pure, absolute authority. Here they are being offered a relationship with one who is good. So wouldn't you, if you were standing there at the foot of this mountain, wouldn't you have said exactly the same thing? In fact, they said it way back in Exodus 19, verse 8, where all the people responded together, "We will do everything the Lord has said. They're longing to be in open, free relationship with this God, with Him dwelling amongst them. And in a sense, that isn't surprising, is it, after all we've seen? But we need to be clear that God isn't fooled by their eager excitement. You see, already they've rebelled against Him in the desert. And in just a couple of chapters in Exodus 32 next week, we're going to see them rebelling against Him again in one of the most profound and ugly rebellions in the whole of the Bible. And I guess even as we have looked at the commands, each of us ourselves have found them acting like a mirror towards us, showing us the filth on our faces, our inability to keep His commands. Surely as we've looked at the commands, we've become aware of numerous acts of rebellion ourselves. And that's why right at the heart of this signing of the Mosaic Covenant, the signing of this relationship, is all this blood. It's there in verse 5. Then He sent young Israelite men, and they offered burnt offerings and sacrificed young bulls as fellowship offerings to the Lord. Moses took half of the blood and put it in bowls, and the other half he sprinkled on the altar. Then he took the book of the covenant and read it to the people. They responded, "We will do everything the Lord has said, we will obey." Moses then took the blood, sprinkled it on the people, and said, "This is the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words." Now, do you see the thinking behind this? The people have said, yes, we will do everything the Lord has said, but God knows better. As He enters into this covenant with them, He knows, and we know, that we never will do everything that the Lord has commanded. It's beyond us. And next week we're going to find out quite how profoundly it is beyond us. And so we discover here in the signing of the agreement that God has already, in the signing of the agreement, made provision for the fact that we are unable to keep His word. And He's made provision with all this blood, which the little footnote at the bottom of the passage tells us is there as a peace offering. See, God knows, we know, that these commands to obey God as our absolute divine authority and our absolute, in His absolute moral purity, are beyond us. Oh, they're good commands. They're great commands. And these verses here, as we see Him making provision for our forgiveness, show us that He is not only good and gracious in the provision of the commands for His people, but that right here, way back, in the signing of the Mosaic Covenant, is an expression of the grace and goodness of God. He is prepared to enter into relationship in spite of our unworthiness. He's prepared to provide for our sin in spite of our failure. And He does it through the provision of a sacrifice that removes His wrath and makes peace with His people. So do you see what we've learned about God this evening? He is holy, altogether other and separate. He is absolute in divine authority. He is absolute in moral purity. God is holy. God is good. The Ten Commands are not there put there by a God like a sort of rather bad schoolmaster wagging his finger at us. No, they're good things. They are for our benefit. And then right at the heart of the signing of this covenant is this provision of grace, the blood that provides peace between a holy God and a fallen people. And it's terrific that now we're moving on to remember the death of Jesus Christ, that fulfillment of this covenant in the new covenant, who provides forgiveness for us today. Now let's take a moment's quiet, and then we're going to sing the next song, Meekness and Majesty.